Any questions, comments, anything you'd like to say from the first session? Oh, is that stimulating, was it? Oh, you're very kind.
I may be jumping the gun a little, but I was wondering how you select these people that we are going to
invest
have
in.
Around our kitchen table.
That's a really, really brilliant question. Who would like to share some wisdom on that? How do you decide who to invest in, as who to disciple, as?
It comes to you and says, look, my walk with God's not up to scratch. I'd like to improve it. Can you help me? They are very ready and very responsive, and that's good soil.
So it's a sign of hunger if they approach you. Okay, yeah.
My mother used to say, he's a BWW.
What's that?
Bloke worth watching.
Ah, a bloke and, worth watching.
And I think as a leader, you start to get a feel as to who's starting to walk their talk and maybe get alongside them.
What about anyone else? How do you decide who to invest in? How have you done it thus far?
Miles, what I tend to do is I tend to look at people. Someone who serves, someone who's willing to serve and stay to the end, someone who sees the things that need doing and do them, and people who actually then draw others in with them to do it.
Yeah.
So who have got an official leadership position, those people who really see the things that need doing and doing them.
They just seem to naturally gather others.
Yes.
Yeah, very good. And servant heart, that's brilliant. I'm going to make notes in a minute. This is all very helpful. How about anyone else? Yeah.
People with initiative.
Initiative. They don't just talk and agree. They go out and they start doing things, initiating things. And then, you step in to guide them.
Yeah, brilliant. Brilliant. Thank you. A chemistry thing. Yeah, that's all good. Yeah, it's all good. So there's got to be some sort of connection, chemistry. You'd want to hang out with them. Yeah, I think that's okay. It's good to say that. Yeah.
Prayer.
Very good. Actually, Jesus spent a night.
People who are frustrated with the status quo.
What if you are the status quo?
Come on.
But can I just say that on that? That's often a sign of leaders often have this this odd tension, this odd almost conflicting emotions of discontent and hope, because they see with greater clarity than many others of what could be, of what will be, of what should be, and they can see therefore that where we're at is not where we should be or could be or will be, and so there's almost a holy discontent with where we're at. So there's a frustration, that sort of discontent, but also a beautiful hope, knowing that God's purposes and plans are perfect and all of that. So it's, and actually I think often it's how you manage that conflict or those opposing emotions which determines whether or not leaders get burnt out or not. Often you get burnt out by leaders who are so, they're so frustrated at where they think we should go and what they should be doing and what should be, that eventually that just wears them down, that tension, because tomorrow's always tomorrow, right? It's never today. So that we need to just, you never stop needing to move on, right? And how you manage that tension determines whether or not you frazzle out and stuff. I think having a very high theology of the sovereignty of God helps. These are all great things, yeah. So we like pray about it. Who kind of fits culturally? Who shows initiative, is a self-starter, who is servant-hearted, who's a gatherer. I think that's really important, especially if what you're doing is a pioneering work. You need gatherers, you really do. Sometimes leaders can, especially your point about wanting to move things on from the status quo, sometimes they can sort of slightly be a bit pointy. Not pointy, that's the wrong way of saying it, but they'll rattle the cage a little bit. And now some of that can be calmed down, and I hope that's not I'm not saying it's a character thing, but if it's a, it's because they've got some get up and go, and they already beginning to see what could be, then that's good to harness as well.
Talking about harnessing, it's about millennials, because most of us will be looking after them.
I got told off over the tea break.
Did you?
Yeah, actually twice. Once for eating two pieces of cake, not yes. One. And the other one for being hard on millennials. I wasn't being hard on millennials.
No, not
at all. I was just saying we got to understand them to be able to release them.
Yes. How might one... The great desire is for authenticity.
Yeah.
And sometimes authenticity might actually go against the flow of actually what maybe God is trying to achieve. How do you bring a millennial, as it were, along with you without creating too much blood on the floor?
Well, I wasn't suggesting you hit them.
So what is the place of loving correction and discipline,
yeah,
and discipleship with a millennial?
So this actually leads quite nicely onto this next piece. Thank you. Segue in. I think I'm not going to do the sort of 10 overlooked traits of leadership. I'd like to just spend a moment, if I may, talking about culture and the power of culture, and then we'll look at church planting. I'm not saying it's right, but what we've tried to do at our church is to have in the culture the importance of feedback. So, and that really comes out of humility. If you're humble, you're teachable. If you're not teachable, often it's because you're not humble. So in everything that we do, we try and release lay leadership as much as possible. We say... that will involve feedback, because and we want to give you feedback and we want to hear your feedback because we love you and we believe in you. And because we love you and we believe in you and in the future that the Lord has for you, we're going to give you constructive feedback. It'd be a lot easier not to do it, because it takes effort to give feedback, it takes time, and sometimes it takes some sort of brutal honesty. But we're going to do it because we want to invest in you, and we love you and we believe in you as a leader. And when you frame feedback like that, even some of the tough conversations, you know why they're happening. So you start with the why. If you explain the why, then the what becomes much easier to take. And it's how you, from Sandy, you could get a right ticking off from Sandy, and you'd leave the vicarage on cloud nine thinking, wow, I'm so loved. You've had it from the best. I think, so we say we're hungry learners. We're a congregation of hungry learners, and we're going to invest in people. And that means, so if somebody's given an opportunity to speak, before we do that, we put them through a very short course, which is a sort of how to preach course. It's broken down into, this is basically how you write a talk. And then second session, this is how you might deliver a talk. But in that, it's also, this is how you give and receive feedback on your talk. And then if somebody's going to preach, we get them to write it. Then they deliver it to us before they give it, and we give them that feedback. Then they give it, and then afterwards we do that feedback. And so every activity has a feedback loop in it. What we say at our church is that failure is not an option. It's a necessity. if you're going to innovate and be creative, failure is a necessity. So failure is completely good with three caveats. Number one, if you're going to fail, fail quickly. Number two, if you're going to fail, make sure there's a feedback loop in place. Because again, this culture of feedback is that with feedback, failure then becomes a really important learning block in the process of development. And the third thing is, if you're going to fail, make sure it's not below the waterline. So there are some things that it's completely cool to fail on. So, you know, if somebody is new on the sound desk and I get up and I say, good morning, hello, can you hear me? Can you hear me? Hello, morning to HTBB. Okay, it's annoying for me. But if it's the first time on the sound desk, and then afterwards a really great constructive feedback conversation happens, so they think, oh yeah, I've got to switch it on. you know, that's a learning opportunity. That failure, it's annoying, but it's not below the waterline. If I run off with someone else's wife as the vicar, that's failure below the waterline. That can sink the whole ship. That is never a good learning opportunity. So we say failure is not an option, it's a necessity, so long as you fail quickly with the proper feedback loop in place and it's not below the waterline. And that's part of the culture we try to create. But people know that everything that they do will involve feedback. Everything, whether it's putting the chairs out, whether it's giving a talk, whether you're on the sound desk, whether it's leading a small group, whether it's making the teas and the coffees, everything has a feedback loop in it at our church. But people know the why. You start with the why. It's because we love you and we're really going to develop you because we believe in your future. With that in place, then it's like, yeah, bring it on, because we're hungry learners. And the same thing, if I preach on a Sunday, I will have a group. I get off the stage at the end of the 9:30. Before the 11:30 starts, give me feedback. And they give me feedback on my sermon so I can make any tweaks before I then get up and deliver it at the 11:30. And then after 11:30, any further feedback, great, I know what to do before the 5. So that's kind of what, I don't know whether that answers your question. But. Well, quickly want to say about culture. You may have seen this in the corporate world, that the big hot topic at the moment, Harvard Business Reviews, etc., is the importance of culture. It used to be all about, you've got to have a vision, then it's, you've got to have a strategy. Now it's, you got to have culture, because culture eats strategy for breakfast. And why is it such a hot topic at the moment? I think it's important for 4 reasons. Number one, culture is a way in which you can leave a lasting legacy. So any organization, a school, a hospital, a business, even a church, takes on a culture like a living organism. It just does. And therefore, if as leaders you can help define and shape that culture, then that will live on long after you've gone. So we talked about the importance of raising up other leaders as a way to leave a lasting, growing, multiplying legacy. Setting culture is another way to ensure legacy. Second reason why culture is important is because it's your point of difference. So in the business sphere, they would say competitors can recruit from the same talent pool as you. They can copy your strategy. They can probably, after a bit of time, bring to market the same products or services as you. But what they can't copy is your culture, because your culture is uniquely you. It's your point of difference. Now, for us as the church, Big C, our competitors are not other churches or other faith-based organizations. Our competitors are the things in the world that steal people's gaze and attention from Christ. The culture of the world that will turn their head the other way. That's what we're competing against. And as the church, we've got something super, really distinctive and unique, which is hugely powerful. Culture is important, ensures legacy. It's your point of difference, makes you unique. Third thing in the business world they're realizing is that culture directly impacts performance and results. So what they say is, let's say you've got company A and company B, and company A and B have similar sort of staff size and talent, similar products, similar services, etc., etc., in the same market. Company A can outperform company B by between 20 to 30% simply by having a stronger, more distinctive culture. So culture can add up to nearly a third on the results over and above the competition. And this is the fourth thing, it also has a direct impact on your staff. So they say that you can reduce churn rates of staff by up to 30% if the staff team know the clear culture in that organization and feel that they fit with it. And what's more, not only do you reduce churn rates by 30%, those staff will work for you for salary up to 7% less than a competitor if they feel they fit the culture. So that's what the business world tells us. And I think some of this is very relevant for the church, because our culture should flow from our values. Values and culture are not the same thing. Your values explain why you do what you do. They're your unchanging beliefs. Your culture explains how you do what you do. They're your behaviors. And culture can, I suppose, could be defined as, this is how we do things around here. That's what culture really means. This is how we do things around here. Values, why? Culture, how? And if there are two words that together, I think, encapsulate what culture is, it would be behavior plus personality. But here's the thing. As a leader, much, much harder to lead in the area of culture than it is vision or values or strategy. Because it seems a bit more subjective. It seems a bit more intangible. It seems it seems a bit more, well, that's what you think. But going back to feedback, if you want to really get a strong culture, you need that feedback loop in place on those cultural things as well. So for example, somebody preached the other week. They preached. Content-wise, very well. They had great eye contact. Their tone of voice was great. Lots of things was great. But one of the things they did was slightly preach down to the congregation. And for us, that sort of goes against one of our, how we do things around here. How we do things around here is we preach up to the congregation. We don't preach down to them. And so I had to kind of call a foul on that one and give feedback on it. Now, you might say, well, that's just style or preference. Maybe, but that's how we do things around here. And so long as you provide clarity and people know that you're giving that feedback from a point of love, then you have to be clear on your culture as well. But that, if you're clear on your culture, wow, it is so powerful over the long run. And I don't know a single growing church that doesn't have a clear culture. So that's just a little bit on culture. Was that helpful at all? Would you be able to define your culture? What is your culture? I mean, you might want to think about that. I'm not, from here. You may want to have a think about that. And they flow from your values, right? So if this thing about raising up other leaders. You wouldn't do that unless you believed that everyone is of value and potential, made in the image of God. And then it flows from that, right? So you may want to actually begin with a previous question, which is, well, what's our values? And then from our values, okay, what's our culture? Culture can evolve, by the way. Your values might be, your beliefs might be unchanging, but your behaviors might evolve over time. We always say, marry the mission, but date the model. You think about that? Okay. Not funny. Move on. Brilliant. Can I talk briefly about church planting? Let's do this. Let's be honest. Who's really not interested in church planting at all? Anybody not interested in church planting? It's okay to say I'm not in the least bit interested in church planting. Is there anybody you're not? Brilliant. Thank you for your honesty. I'll give you an extra piece of cake for sitting through this next bit. Is anybody here who's really interested in church planting? Who wants to? Okay. Is that enough of us? Those who are sitting on the fence, my objective is that you'll be really interested by the end of this presentation. Okay. It will help if I get my church planting notes out. There we go. Well, it's been said that church planting is the most effective means under heaven of seeing the kingdom of God grow. And we certainly see that in the New Testament with the life of Paul. And what I'm going to suggest in this presentation is, if I may, talk a little bit about the second half. I'm going to talk a little bit about Alpha. But what we've been doing over the last 3 years is seeing how Alpha can be a tool, not just for church growth in an existing church, but it can also be used as a church planting tool. And our story is that's kind of how our church began. So I was as the associate vicar at HTB in London, the church where Alpha was birthed out of, and Chinese, Malaysian young woman came and studied in the UK, and then before heading back home to KL, she came and did an internship at HTB in London. She went back to KL to start working for her family business and thought, this is great, I'm going to try running an Alpha for my friends. So she ran an Alpha in her home. They used the videos, and quite a few of her friends in their early 20s came to faith, and they said, this is brilliant, can we do another one for some of our friends? So they ran another Alpha in her home. Some more of them came to faith, and then they started praying together every Tuesday night after work. And this group grew slightly, and they got to about 25 people praying on a Tuesday night, sensing that the Lord had brought them to faith and brought them together for a reason, for a purpose, but they didn't know what it was. At this point, two things happened in London. One was we decided that there were now so many Alpha courses, so many churches wanting to use Alpha in Asia and asking us to help, that we really needed to serve them better, set up a proper, what we call regional Asia-Pacific hub to serve the churches and aid the work in Asia. We'd never really had a proper Asia-Pacific hub before. So Nikki said, we need somebody to go and do that. I'd had a prophecy in my life 19 years beforehand, so I said, yeah, okay, I'll do it. And at that point, the Anglican Bishop of West Malaysia, who has a vision to see church planting in his diocese, it's 60% Muslim, to go from 140 Anglican churches to 200. So he needed to, he felt like the Lord say, plant another 60 churches. He'd started with 100. He'd done 40 himself, but in his tenure. But they were mainly in what's called the kampungs, the jungle villages. But he hadn't done a city center one. So he said, okay, where in the Anglican globe have they done church planting in a city centre context to create a resource church for the diocese? Oh, Holy Trinity Brompton. So he invited us to plant, and we said, well, that's great, because we want to set up this Alpha Hub so we can have the hub housed in a local church, because, you know, Alpha, we don't think of ourselves as a parachurch organisation. Nobody owns Alpha. It's just a tool birthed in a local church. We share it with other churches, and they share it, and go and share it with other churches as well. So we said, that'll show who we are. It'll replicate who we are. So let's have the Alpha Asia Hub in this church. And at HTBB, so it's the name of the church we planted, Holy Trinity Bukit Bintang, we said, okay, great. We can look like, well, what does a church look like if Alpha isn't just, let's say this iPhone was a church. If you just run Alpha is one more program of many. It's like you've just put an app on your phone that says Alpha. But what if Alpha wasn't just used as an app? What if Alpha was the operating system for this phone? What would that look like if Alpha was your iOS? So that's what we've tried to experiment with and model at HTBB and KL. So we said, okay, invitation to plant a church, vision to set up an Alpha Hub to serve the churches in Asia where the demand is going off the scale. How are we going to do it? Because I only know this one girl who came and did an internship with us in Asia, contacted her. She said, oh, we're now 25 of us praying for an exciting project that the Lord's called. It's like, oh, can I come and see you? So actually I Skyped into this home group on a Tuesday night, shared the vision. They said, okay, we're in. So I'm married to Sarah. We took obviously our three kids with us, so that was five more. That's helpful. And then there were three couples, crazy enough to leave London and come back, go to KL with us. Two were Malaysians already, actually, so they were going back. And so 11 of us arrived. There were 25 there. We began with 36. I began in someone's house, worshipped there, doubled in size, and then from there moved into the premises. Okay, so that's a little bit of the backstory. Oh, I'm going to need to do it over here, don't I? Oh, thank you. Did I do that or did you do that? You did it. Thank you very much. I suppose what I want to say up front is there are many, many different models to church planting. There isn't just one model. If you say an existing church, let's say you have a 9 a.m. service and you decide, okay, let's start a 11 a.m. service. In a way, you're planting a new service. Many of the principles we're going to talk about might apply to planting new services. You might plant into a new building. You might graft into an existing church. You might do a missional community or do a new initiative in a school or something. There are many, many different models, and that's good. Variety in the kingdom normally is a good idea, right? And each model will be best suited to a particular place or a particular people group or a particular leadership style or whatever. So you can work out the model that's best for you and what the Lord might call you to. I'm not saying any model is better than another, but all I can do is share with you our model. And the model that we have was basically developed by HTB in London. It first planted a church in 1985, St. Barnabas Kensington, wasn't it? The first one they did in 85. Then in 87, they did St. Mark's Battersea Rise and planted roughly about every 2 years. But then they worked out, actually, we need to plant pregnant churches. So we need to plant churches that will plant churches. And that way is the way that you accelerated. So this is basically learning from HTB in London over about a 30-year period. And what they do is begin by planting, you start with like a what I call a city center resource church or town centre resource church. In medieval days, it would be the Minster that would be able to help support and resource all of the planting and mission work across the area. And typically, one of these town or city resource churches would need to grow to at least about 1,000. We say 1,000 because then you've got enough size and resource, whether that be people or money, to be able to help resource the work. But let's say this blue blob is an area of Auckland, right? A blob of Auckland. You're over here, and you've noticed that you've grown to quite a good size, but you notice that, oh, there are some people that commute in from this area to our church. What we could then do is, what we do is call it, and let's say we're 1,000 plus, we plant what we call a first generation plant, which is a church that would typically grow, I'm just talking about an urban context here. If you're in a less urban context, the principle is exactly the same, just the numbers might be slightly different. So don't get hung up on the numbers, but think about the principles. But what we found in London was you'd plant from a big city centre resource church into an area here, typically could grow to about 300, first-gen plant. Then you might notice that, oh, over here is an area where people live who are coming to this church. So why not plant here, second-gen plant? So that's your pregnant church. Gen 1 is pregnant when you plant it. They then plant. And they typically grow to about 150 in size. But what if they notice that, oh, we're drawing people around these localities? Well, there's no reason why you can't plant a third-generation church. And they typically might be about 50 people. But you could do it multiple times. And then you could repeat this all over the blob. And suddenly, you're really, really reaching your area for Christ. It's quite a sacrificial thing. Because if you plant in the short term, all of those people then get saved and come to Christ and are discipled. They're kind of in somebody else's church. Like, oh, but can't I just have all of these in here? Then I look really good. They're not going to come in here. It's why we go to them. And think of, not only have you reached all these extra people, but think of all these extra leaders who have stepped up to the plate. You've released leadership potential in planting. We've seen that time and time again. People who, if they stay at the mothership, as it were, only have so many opportunities to serve. But if they go out as a plant team, wow, they've got space to lead in ways that if they'd stayed back, they might never have. And then suddenly you think, look at all that potential flourish. I had no idea that Janet could preach like that, or Dave was that good at worship, or whatever, or that Steve could disciple children's church like that. Wow, didn't see that coming, but given the opportunity, the right context, the right calling, so you reach a lot more people, but also you release so much more leadership potential in the kingdom. Okay, this is a really horrid chart. I probably don't need to tell you that, but bear with me. I don't know what Auckland's like, but many, many cities are kind of, you have, by and large, three zones. You have a sort of city center, which is the middle bit. In lots of cities, many people don't live in the city center. But they do travel into the city center, either for work, offices, like CBD, or to shop. Lots of department stores and stuff. But for historical reasons, you do have some city center churches. And often resource churches might be in the city center. Then typically, there's an inner city. And the inner city is the ring or the area where you get this weird hybrid of some long-term indigenous locals. They've been there for generations. but also it's often where immigrants or refugees are placed. Housing is a bit cheaper, a little bit more shabby chic, and the vibe is sort of community, but community in pockets, in silos. So we'll stick together, we'll stick together, we'll stick together. But in those pockets, you get genuine community. And then if you go a bit further out, you hit the suburbs. Suburbs, fat lots of families. Young professionals often live here because they're on the bottom rung of the work ladder. They don't have a load of money yet to buy an expensive property, but also they want to be quite near to work and where all the socializing happens. You get married, have kids. Oh no, we need space. Into the suburbs. Now, is Auckland roughly like that or not? No. tell me. Yeah. Okay, so the families are further out. That's correct, right? Okay, so this urban... There's no cheap middle ground. So what do you do when you first start work or you're not very wealthy? You live out here, do you? Okay. Well, this is great. I mean, what I would do is on a big piece of paper, get some of you together and map this out. Map it out. And then you start to dream and get a plan. But the principles are this. Let me just share with you. If you're doing like a city center or resource church, 1,000+, the only way to do that is you have to be attractional. You have to be attractional. Because you're not going to get that big just by being local in our parish sort of thing. And a attractional church looks slightly different, doesn't it? And people will come to an attractional church from all over the city. That's okay. If you're in this ring or wherever this may be in Auckland, or it's much more community-based. Don't try and do attractional church in a community-based locale. You've got to do missional church. They're not going to come to you. You've got to go to them. And it's much more about mums and toddlers groups, those conversations at the school, those conversations in your local coffee shop. It's about doing community work. It's about getting out there, not just come to our patch, but we bless you on your patch as well. It's more of a missional model. When you get to where the families are, suburbia, typically it's a hybrid. So families may move around the suburban area to find the church of their preference, but they're not going to go here or here so much. And again, suburban church, they have attractional elements, but they also have that missional pieces to them as well. That's what we've seen in many cities around the world. Auckland might be different, but you can work this out. But I suppose all I'm really trying to say from that chart is location, location, location. Your location should determine your model of church. It doesn't work the other way around. You've got to work out where you are and think, okay, then this is, if I'm called here, then this is how we should do church. And that'll determine what sort of church you plant. Okay, if you want to plant a church, there are four core elements to planting a church. First of all, you need some, this is meant to be a bishop's mitre, you need some form of authority. Right, authority comes from being under authority, right? Matthew 8, when the centurion says to Jesus, "Will you, my servant's sick, will you heal them?" Jesus goes, "Okay, I'll come with you." And he says, "No, you don't need to come, just say the word. I understand how authority works. I'm a man under authority, and I have men under authority, under my authority, so I know, just give the command." And Jesus goes, "Wow, I've not found understanding like this in all of Israel." The centurion understood that he only has authority because he's under authority. And if you're going to plant a church, It's a whole lot easier if you don't go as a lone ranger. So you come under the authority of either your bishop or your superintendent, or if you don't have those structures, your senior pastor who's sending you out. Whatever it may be, you need some authority over you. It's not only who is a go-to person when you need help, but more importantly than that, somebody who's going to be spiritually over you to stop you going slightly crazy. Obviously, you then need a leader, and the leader needs a team. Typically, we say you need a team of at least five. So we would typically say you have a senior pastor, you have an assistant pastor, you have a worship leader, you have a children's or youth worker, and you have some sort of ops person. Now, not all of them need to be full-time. Not all of them need to be salaried, if at all. But you do need those roles on the bus taken. And then our model would be you also need a bit of oomph. So if you start as pastor and spouse to try and plant a church, and it's literally just the two of you, it's going to take, at least 2 years to get a group, of, say, 50 people this size. Whereas if you can have that core team sent with a group of 30 to 50 people day one, you begin with momentum. Therefore, what you can achieve is fast forwarded by at least 2 to 3 years. So we always send a team out as well. So these are people in the existing church who have catch the vision. Maybe they live in that locality, or they have some emotional connection to it, or they just feel called by the Lord, or they feel called to follow the leader because they connect with that leader and they say, okay, we'll go. And so we typically send out a team of 30 to 50. Can be done with less, as you'll see in a moment, but that's typically been our model from the resource church. Then you need a building or a place. You don't need to own the building, but you need somewhere to gather. We started in a home, and then we moved into what used to be a theatre. And we're about to, because we've outgrown it, we're about to move into what used to be a nightclub. But we get to keep the theatre because it's next door. And we're going to move our 3 English-speaking services into the nightclub. And our next run of Alpha from the 20th of September, we're actually going to run 2 Alphas simultaneously, one in English, one in Mandarin. And then off the back of the Mandarin one, in January, we'll run a second run of Alpha in Mandarin. And then in Easter, in our current existing space, we're going to start a Chinese service. So that's kind of, again, using Alpha to plant a new service. But you need some space to meet. And you need resource. It's simple, right? So those are the 4 building blocks you need in place if you're going to plant a church. Now, what are the steps in this planting process? Well, I think it takes normally about 2 years from the idea to being able to do a church plant. Some smiles around. Maybe some people are doing it a lot quicker, I don't know. But often 2 years out, you're sensing either the senior pastor who's going to send out the church plant, or the leader as well, often sensing a call from the Lord that maybe he's in this. By about 1 year out, you're seriously in the discovery phase. By that, you're discovering place, you're discovering building, you're discovering potential team members, you're discovering who might want to help support it to begin with financially, etc., etc. 6 months out, you need to announce it. And then 3 months, it's all hands on deck preparation, then you launch. It's good to have a 100-day plan. You know, when a new president comes to office, they have a 100-day plan. Obviously, it's not going to go to plan, right? The first casualty in war is the plan, always, right? I think Mike Tyson used to say, every boxer has a plan till they get hit. And it's not going to work out as you plan, but it's better to aim at something than to aim at nothing, right? If you aim at nothing, you're sure to hit it. And by a plan, it would be, so it might, for us, it was this, okay, we're going to launch our first Sunday service on this date. Then we're going to start Alpha 3 weeks later on this date. And then we're just going to do Sunday service and Alpha for that first semester. Then out the back of the Alpha, we need to have ready X number of people who can do 3 home groups for the people who come to faith so we can get them discipled. But then we need this many who can then come back and help on the next Alpha. And we'll run that through to Easter. And then at that point, we'll be able to do... And you see, so you've at least got a 100-day plan, knowing that it won't all work out, but you've at least got something to aim at. Then, Then typically by the sort of 2 years plus onwards, you're thinking about growth, but also having to take disciple making much, much more seriously. And then by years 4 to 5, you need to start thinking about planting. The research shows that if a church does not plant by year 4 or 5, they're much, much less likely to ever plant. Because things over time, concrete just sets. So it's if you're going to say we're a church plant that's going to church plant, then you need to be thinking to do it around the year four to five mark. Okay, here's a little case study from East London to show why this works. So anybody been to London ever? Oh, a lot. East London? Okay, so East London is sort of inner city. EastEnders, you may have seen the EastEnders. It's a mix of indigenous working class white, yuppies, who are on the low rung of the career ladder, but they're only going to be there a couple of years, then they move on, and Bangladeshi immigrants. That's a lot of East London. Quite a lot of deprivation. And for the Anglican Church, when we plant churches, what we're really doing, by and large, is restarts. Because there are 16,000 Anglican church buildings just in England. That's a lot of Anglican churches, right? So we don't need to build new buildings or whatever. We're often, when you plant into, from an Anglican point of view, it's because you've got Saint whatever's, let's say you've got Saint Ethelbert's. I'm guessing there's not a Saint Ethelbert's here, so okay. Saint Ethelbert's. Saint Ethelbert's is not in good shape. The congregation is down to 7 old ladies and a dog. The previous parish priest had to basically take time off for depression. The current one ran off with the other dog that was in the congregation. The roof's leaking. It's going to cost 2 million quid to fix, and there's no money. When it's that bad, the bishop goes, oh, what am I going to do? And this is where church planting can help. So what it is let's say you've got a church over here that's flourishing, that's healthy, that has resource in terms of people and a bit of money. They can help send in a team. And they go in, and they love the 7 old ladies and the dog. They don't want the 7 old ladies and the dog to leave, but they do a restart. And that's how in the Anglican Church you basically plant. And the philosophy is you honor the past, you navigate change in the present, and you build for the future. And what happened here was a wonderful predecessor of mine at HTB called Rick Thorpe. He was at HTB, and then he went to plant into a church called St. Paul's Shadwell. Great church, but basically in the wrong place. Because you've got a big, big church here with a massive immigrant Bangladeshi community all around it, a huge dual carriageway, busy traffic there. And then on the other side of the road, the housing where yuppies or the indigenous white people would live. And it had dwindled down to 12 old ladies, basically. And he planted from HTB into St. Paul's Shadwell in 2005. And he took with him 100 people. They had a baby just before they left, and the baby was person number 100. They thought they were taking 99 and then gave birth. And so they took 100 people, which is quite a lot. Normally, it wouldn't give that sort of size. But it took 100. There were 12 there, and 11 of the 12 stayed. That's good, right? Really good. And the size now is 250. But this is what they also did. These are all in the same deanery, which is a really rough part of the East End. St. Peter's Bethnal Green was another struggling church with 20 people in it. Half of them were nuns. And what St. Paul's Shadwell did is they sent one of the curates from here to go and be the vicar. And this was by year 5, 2010. And Adam took with him a team of 20 from St. Paul's. So St. Paul's goes up to 250, he takes 20. What they find is very quickly that 20 you've given away fills up again, because you can't outgive God, right? And they're now, so 20 plus 20, but they're now at 150. So what happens next? Oh, All Hallows Bow. I mean, this is the out of all these, socially, this is the toughest. This is, Tower Hamlets, really rough. 7 people left in it. So a guy goes from here, actually, Shadwell again, to here. He takes 10 with him. Week 1 that he's there, 2 things happen. Number 1, one evening, somebody's stabbed to death on the steps outside the church. And number 2, he's moved into the vicarage with his wife and his small kids, and a brick is thrown through his window with a message on it saying, get out. So, really warm welcome, week 1, that he's there. They've gone, 7 plus 10, they're now at 140. That is an extraordinary job that he's done there. Because he had to also convert these 7 and the dog. Then another guy from here, goes to St. Luke's Millwall. 15 there, 20, then out 75. The reason why that's a good achievement is they don't even have a building. They have to move from place to place to place. They're trying to actually lock down a place they can rent full time. So to do that basically out the back of a car is quite impressive. And then this is something completely different. This is sort of the cathedral of that little patch of East London. It's called Christ Church Spitalfields. It's an iconic building. It's enormous, huge white spire, protected by every heritage law under the sun. You can't change a thing about it. They had a morning congregation, but they had no evening congregation. So they said, we need to do something in the evening, because everybody around this area has suddenly become really cool. They've all got moustaches like Fraser. You know, they're all hipster, and we haven't got a clue how to reach them. And they're not up in the morning, so we need to do something in the evening. Help. So St. Paul's Shadwell sent a team. I put here 20 to 50 because they're still trying to work out how many actually went. They're still debating. But the evening service now at 150. So when you add all of that up, look, this is in 9 years. So 5 churches had a total combined congregation of 54 people. 5 churches, 54 people. Then they plant, they send in 220 in total. They've now got a combined congregation of 765. I tell you, That's an additional 550 people in church in Tower Hamlets. That's not far off revival if you know that part of town. That is the power of planting. Church planting works. Now, do any of these vicars, do they look at the size of their churches, do they feel like megastars? No. Is that the kingdom of God at work? Yes. That is super powerful. That is well done, good and faithful servant. You're changing your community for Christ. So this is the power of church planting. I just want to finish with a last couple of charts, and then we'll have questions. To the positives of using Alpha as a church planting tool. Number one, it provides a growth engine. You know, when you plant, you got to grow. That's the first priority thing you got to do. You got to grow. Why? Because you start with no one. You start with a small team that is not financially viable. We had 36 people. It's really hard to do a church with 36 people because you don't have enough manpower, you don't have enough money, you don't, etc. So you've got to grow. You've got to grow somehow. And for us, Alpha has been very effective at bringing in new people. And as people come as guests and they have an amazing experience on Alpha, and you invite them to maybe to come, some of them, to come back and be helpers on the next course, and to bring their friends, you're constantly tapping into new friendship networks to invite. Then they invite their friends, they come as guests, and then on the next Alpha, you ask those guests, new guests, to invite their friends, and you tap into new friendship networks. So you're constantly tapping into new friendship networks rather than asking a set congregation, hey, invite your friends. Eventually, they've invited all their friends. There's no more friends to invite. But with Alpha, you're constantly tapping into those new friendship networks as people come as guests, helpers, leaders in the small groups. So it helps you grow. It's a growth engine. Secondly, it communicates vision and values. So what we were talking earlier, and also culture, actually, I should put on that chart. It says that evangelism is at the core of who we are. It's important. It says that we are open and hospitable. We provide welcome and home for people. It says we're dependent on the Holy Spirit. These are some of the values hardwired in Alpha that then are embraced by your church and everybody gets to understand it. It was the wonderful brain that was Bishop Leslie Newbegin who said that evangelization, having evangelism front and center, is important for three reasons. Number one, if it isn't the number one priority in your church, it's not a question of if you'll die out, but when. Number two, he said it's the best way to ensure theological orthodoxy. Because churches that are inward looking eventually end up believing some weird things. He says, whereas actually, if you place looking outwards and evangelism front and center, it keeps you orthodox in your theology. And then thirdly, he said it's actually the only way to ensure unity in the broader church, because it's the one thing that pretty much everybody can agree on, because nobody wants to die out. Whereas if we try and unify around our ecclesiology, our church style, forget it. If we're going to try to unify around our sacramentalism, we're going to differ. On the finer points of our doctrine, we're going to differ. But the need to reach out, we can agree on that. So by having Alpha as one of your church planting tools, it helps cement some of these important values in your community. Thirdly, as we've spoken before, it's great for raising up leaders. When you plant a church, the first thing you realize is you don't have enough people. You don't have enough leaders. Because those you start with a small number of people, and they're running around trying to do everything. So you need to not only grow your congregation, you also got to grow leaders. And actually, the rate at which you can plant in the future, by year 4 or 5 onwards, the rate at which you then plant isn't just a function of your size, it's a function of your leader readiness. Because what you do is when you plant, you give away people. Let's say you give away 30 people. Pretty quickly, you might be able to fill 30 seats again. But the people who go on a plant tend to be your leaders, the pioneering types, the one that catch the vision, the let's make it happen type people who are probably serving in your church. This is the cost of planting. I'm not going to lie to you, it's really costly because it's those sort of people who often go, put up their hands and say, yeah, let's do it. The Lord's in this. So you might fill their seats up once they've gone relatively quickly, but it takes longer to raise up the same number of leaders again in your church. So when you plant, what it wakes you up to is the need to be super intentional in your leadership development, which we were talking a little bit about earlier on this morning. And the way that Alpha does it is you can take somebody who's a guest, they come on Alpha, they come to Faith, they then you invite them back to help in a small group on the next run, they do a good job, so you invite them to come back as a leader of a small group on the next run. And depending on how frequently you run your Alpha, you can take somebody from a non-believer to beginning to be a leader in your church in a year. So it's a good on-ramp at the start of your discipleship process. Fourth reason why it's great is it gets everybody involved. You know, not everybody, you need to grow when you plant a church, but not everybody's a natural evangelist, one-on-one. You know, I'm not a great natural evangelist one-on-one. I'm actually quite shy one-on-one. But Alpha says, okay, you don't need to be a great evangelist. Peter, we know, was a great evangelist. He stands up on the day of Pentecost, preaches a sermon, 3,000 are saved. Never happened to me. But think of Andrew. What did Andrew do? Well, actually, Andrew encountered Jesus first. Then he went to his brother and said, hey, Peter, I think I may have found the Messiah. Come and see. And all he did was he just invited Peter to go with him to explore who Jesus was. That's basically what happens when people invite friends on Alpha. So you don't have to convert them. All you have to say is come and see. Come and give it a try. If you don't like it, don't come back. If you do, come back. But I think it'll be a lot of fun. I'm helping in a small group. You can join my group. Just come. So people can either just invite or they can help put out the chairs. They can help cook the food. They can do the flyers. There's so many different jobs to do. Whatever your skill set, you can feel like, wow, I'm helping evangelize our neighborhood, our community. It's a bit like the story of the guy who was sweeping the floors in the corridor, the janitor at NASA, and the president walks by and asks him, what are you doing? He goes, Mr. President, I'm putting a man on the moon. And then Captain, you know, everybody's involved in the pro. Everybody can get involved in evangelization because most of us feel like we should be evangelizing, but we're not very good at it, so we don't do it, and we just feel guilty. Now you can do it. Get involved. This is a picture of our central course. So this is our hall that used to be a theater on top of the shopping mall in KL. We typically these are our small groups, 10 to 12 people each. We typically can fit about 14 or 15 small groups in the room, and we do it Wednesday night. We start serving food from 7. We have a hard start at 8. We finish at 9:30. I'm the only one with blonde hair in the room, I'm afraid. I stand out. Fifth reason why Alpha is a good planting tool is it's about evangelism, but it also disciples in the basics. And the wonderful thing about it is, you know, what is evangelism? Where does evangelism stop and where does discipleship start? Well, I'm not so sure it does, right? It's all discipleship in a way. And what you're doing with a guest on Alpha is look at some of the topics. Who is Jesus? Why did he die? Why and how can I pray? How can I have faith? Why and how can I pray? Why and how should I read the Bible? How does God guide us? How do I resist evil? Does God heal today? What about the church? I mean, these are discipleship questions. And what you're doing is the guest is being discipled without them realizing it. They're starting their discipleship journey before maybe they've even come to that place of decision of coming to faith. So it's a good way of discipling the basics. Sixthly, this is important. If Alpha is your growth engine when you plant a church, it communicates to other churches that you're not after their sheep. Because if front and center is a tool for evangelism to reach those who don't go to church, what you're saying to all your other churches around you is, I've not rocked up in town to try and steal your flock. And that's important, because then you make friends very quickly. And the commandment is, go and make disciples, not go and take disciples. Seventhly, and don't underestimate this, it provides a rhythm and consistency to church life. So our congregation knows that we run it 3 times a year, and all of our other activities fit around that. And why do we do it? Because there's always somebody who wants to come on Alpha. So if somebody says, oh, wait. So last night I spoke at, what was it, Green Lane Christian Center? A guy there comes up to me at the end and says, kind of new to church, quite like to try Alpha. When's the next one? So I don't know. I ask somebody, when's the next one? They go, oh, in 2 weeks' time. Brilliant. But what if they turn around to that guy and said, oh, in 10 months' time, we're running it? He might have been like, oh, yeah, maybe church isn't for me. He's only got to wait 2 weeks. It's not long. So if there's always somebody wanting to come. And the other thing is, the most powerful sort of inviters, like Andrew saying to Peter, come and see, are the guests who've just done the course. Because they just think, this is life-changing. I love it. When are they most effective and most enthusiastic to invite friends? At that moment, when they've just come off that course, harness that enthusiasm when it's hottest. If they then got to wait 10 months before the next course to invite their friends, somehow the power of their invite to their friends is less powerful. Oh, come and do this course. When did you do it? 10 months ago. It's not quite as powerful. Come, just this course, it's amazing. When did you do it? Oh, a month ago. It's brilliant. And in 10 months' time, they may have forgotten how much they loved it. They've just got into the Christian bubble then. And it keeps momentum. Anybody who's planted a church will know that this, the M word, is so important. It's intangible. It's hard to define. But once you've got momentum, it's almost impossible to stop it. Once you lose momentum, it's really hard to get it going again. And just that rhythm of Alpha, it keeps the wheels turning. It keeps momentum. That's just boring. That's the red bits. I don't know whether somebody was having a drink at this point, but the red is when we ran Alpha. And I mean, what we've seen with our Sunday headcount is that. By the way, Sunday headcount does not tell the story of the health of your church. The only reason why we count it is because it's one of the few tangibles you can measure with church, right? But please don't judge the health of a church on its headcount. But you might as well measure it because you can. And it tells you something. It's not the full picture. It tells you something. And typical church planning theory says you hit ceilings. So normally church growth goes boing, 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 and each one of those plateaus, you might, unless you change something or adapt a few things, you might stop at that plateau. And the plateaus are simple. Normally the first ceiling is 100, then it sort of doubles, it's like 200, 400, 800. 800 is an interesting ceiling, because they say that once you get through 800, you then don't plateau again until 2000, if your building's big enough. Or if you have maybe you have a dispersed model. But what we've noticed, interestingly, with our figures, is that all of that sort of written-up theory on church planting hasn't really applied. The growth line has just been quite steady and linear for us. And I don't know. This is not proof. But the only thing I can think is that the only thing we've done consistently, non-stop, is Alpha. And I think because we've just kept it going, we've not had those plateau moments yet, anyway. Okay, so Questions on church planting? Yeah. Mary. Is it Mary?
Yes. I was just wondering, with that whole trying to stop other churches thinking that you're taking their flock and whatnot, do you have stats on whether they're new Christians or whether they have just come from other churches, or is that too hard to measure?
For HTBB?
Yeah, just with the experience of, or maybe even in the London churches.
I don't have those stats. What I do know is we did this past year a global piece of research on Alpha by a research group called Barna. And what the Barna study was running in 11 countries around the world, looking at many, many churches that run Alpha. And it did the research with the guests on Alpha, the small group leaders and helpers, the course administrators, and the senior pastors. And they asked them questions just before they did Alpha and then after Alpha. And one of the simple questions was looking at who the guests were that come on Alpha. And of the 11 countries, 10 of them broadly showed the same breakdown of who the guests were. And the breakdown was that half, 50% of the guests were Christian and already attending church. Whether it was that particular church or not, I don't know. So 50%, you've got churchgoers. The other 50% were split between half of them, so 25% of the guests, would tick a box saying, yes, I'm Christian, but when the question was, do you go to church ever, the answer was no. So they affiliate with somehow see themselves as Christian, but they don't actually go to church. And then the other half, so the other 25%, are you a Christian? No. So broadly speaking, churchgoers, you've got 50% of the guests churchgoers, 50% not. Gender split was 60% female, 40% male. The only country out of the 11 that completely bucked all of this trend was India. India, 80% of the guests Hindu, unsurprisingly, and about 75% male. So slightly different. But whether that 50% that said Christian, yes, and go to church, whether they were from somebody else's church or not, we didn't ask that question. I don't know. Yeah.
Well, it's one thing that Rick, the guy who was planting that church, now bishop doing church planting, done some research, and he said that in the areas where church planting is done, every other church in that area grows, which is very, very interesting.
Actually, Hillsong recently also did some research into this, because it was a big critique of them is, oh no, the Hillsong bus has rocked up in town. Our church is going to empty. And what they found is the answer to that question, does that happen, really, really depends at what point you measure it. So year one, some of that is true. So when Hillsong rocks up, year one, other churches in the area do lose some of their congregation. But if you go out to by year three, similar thing. They've grown versus before. So even when a massive church rocks up to plant, somehow, I think it's a kingdom principle or something. I don't quite understand it. But if you measure it 3+ years out, the rising tide has risen all ships, not just the one. But in year one, there may be a bit of that going on. We generally say if somebody's come from another church, oh, so glad you're visiting. I'm sure they absolutely love you at your church. You must be an amazing leader for them. In other words. But at the end of the day, you can't force people, right? It's a free country. You can't say, you know, I think I've seen you before. You're from another church. And you'll go and rugby tackle them and strong arm them out the door. It's still a free country. People will vote with their feet. But you can be inspired by what others are doing.
With the model that you described in the church growth, five new churches, how does the denominational requirements for church leadership play into that? How do you fulfill those requirements, or do you?
Yeah, so with being Anglican, most Anglican churches require somebody to be priested, to lead it, because you're meant to celebrate communion on a weekly basis, and you can't preside unless you're priested. So for the Anglicans to do this, it's quite hard, because you've got to have ordained leaders. And to get ordained in the Anglican church, you then got a whole selection process, and then X years of training, then you've got to serve a curacy, go from deacon to priest, and then from being a curacy, go and plant. So some denominations are harder than others, and I'd say for the Anglicans, the bar's quite high. What it means is you've got to plan ahead, and you've got to just get more intentional with your leadership development, which is one reason why in the Diocese of West Malaysia, when I arrived, myself and my curate, we were already priested, but we had to, when from the London Diocese, but we had to get licensed in the Diocese of West Malaysia. So we went to the service. They said, we've got our ordination service happening. We'll license you at the same service where we ordain the deacons, the new deacons, and we ordain the priests who were deaconed last year. So I went to the licensing service. And I thought, that's odd. There are three being deaconed and two being priested. They must just do these every month or something like that. But no, that's their annual ordination service. So they were just ordaining three new people that whole year. I thought, oh my goodness, what if the vision that we've been invited by the bishop is to set up a resource church, city center, that will then provide the leaders and the resource to help planting another 60 churches across the country. The pipeline's bare. We're going to have to raise up a lot of leaders ourselves. And then when I started talking to this one guy called Kelvin, who wanted to get ordained, we saw that the style of training was such, it was going to take him 7 years. But there's a whole load of, for every Kelvin, there's another 10 Kelvins out there who would be brilliant pioneering leaders. But if they think, oh, well, I've got to do 7 years of part-time theological study, forget it. Hey, mates, let's open a coffee bar. You know, so we then went to the bishop and said, I don't think the model is going to work to get the pipeline, to get the but in London, what they've done is they've opened up St. Melitus. They do mixed mode training where the theory and practice go hand in hand. They do it in 3 years, 2 to 3 years, and bang, look at the pipeline of planters they've got in the London diocese now. And it's like, oh yeah, let's do it. So that's why we then started up. So I think our bar is quite high, but it doesn't mean it's impossible. You just got to get super intentional and plan ahead.
Hey, what's your model for implementing Alpha successfully in an already established small to medium-sized church with limited resources, team, and momentum? Your time starts now.
The single most important thing to determine a successful Alpha course is the quality of the small group hosts and helpers that you appoint. And I say that you appoint. Don't say, we want to do Alpha. Who wants to be a small group host or helpers? All the wrong hands will go up. You have to appoint them. You choose them, and you go up and do the personal appointing. Who makes a good host or helper in a small group? Think, okay, whose party would I want to go to? You know, who's going to be... Because hosting a small group, we say to each of our small group hosts, it's your party, think of it like a party. Make people have a lot, you know, so you host them, you pour them the drinks, you say, hey, do you want to bring a cake next week? Give them like homemade biscuits or whatever. And so you want gatherers. They don't have to be deeply theological. because the content comes from the video or the live talks. They just need to be people, and people who know how to listen, not to dominate. So you have to then train them so that they ask questions, but then they listen and they love. But the other really important thing is that the people that you reach as guests will mirror the demographic profile of the people that you have as hosts and helpers. So if you have a bunch of hosts and helpers in their 70s, the guests will probably be in their 60s or 70s and maybe some in their 80s, because typically we attract people plus or minus 10 years of where we're at. If you want to reach 20-somethings, you better get 20-somethings leading. And you may say, well, I've only got a very small number of 20-somethings. Fine, doesn't matter. But just get them. You have to start big. You can start small. And then they will invite friends who will then invite friends who will then. And the other thing you need to do is keep on moving people through that arc of guest to helper to host, guest to helper to host. If you have the same people leading the small groups every single run of Alpha, two things happen. Number one, they get burnt out. And number two, they run out of people to invite. But if you get that through pull, you're constantly accessing those new friendship networks. It's really, that's probably not a very sophisticated answer, but does that help in any way? Yeah.
And Miles, in terms of research that's been done in the UK, the Church Army has just produced a report from its research unit on church planting, in particular fresh expressions of church. So look up the Church Army in the UK.
Yeah.
Some fascinating stuff coming out of it. Two of the important things for me is that, first of all, significant numbers of the fresh expressions of church that are being produced are run by lay people.
Yeah.
So we dodge the problem of ordination.
Yeah.
It raises other problems, but it's that kind of thing that's going on. The second thing that is, and my figure may be wrong, but I think they said that in 10 years from 2014, in 10 years, they are now in fresh expressions of church, something like between 5 and 10% of the worshipping population of the Anglican Church in the UK.
Yeah.
So it's a model which is well worth it. Well, it's not a model. It's a gazillion models.
Yes.
Well worth a look. But have a look at the research. I don't mean you. I mean anyone around.
Yeah, thank you.
Have a look at the research that's available, because it can give us some means of subverting our structures, which often get narrow.
Yes. Thank you. That's really, really helpful. The just two comments on that, if I may. Number one, I know that just as I was leaving the UK, so I'm a bit out of date now, but they were thinking of the bishop that was overseeing fresh expressions. They were now saying, okay, we need the bishop who oversees church planting to also oversee fresh expressions, because fresh expression is a way of church planting. The number one challenge with fresh expression is legacy. How can that community still be live, vibrant, and growing in 100 years' time? And that's why they said, okay, let's put it under church planting, because some of the church planting stuff kind of somehow ensures the legacy. The second thing on lay leadership, I'm all for it. In Asia, it's massive. Actually, what's really big in Asia that I've not really seen quite work anywhere else to the same extent is what they call bivocational leadership, where somebody has a sort of 9-to-5 job, but they're also pastoring a growing church. I've seen that in the UK, but they're always pastoring a static or declining church. I've never somehow seen it that somebody who's bivocational can somehow manage to be successful in their career and grow a flourishing church. In Asia, that's very common. So I'm trying to work out what it is that's different in the bivocational model there than what I've seen in the UK. Once I've worked it out, I'll let you know. But
Well, guys, why don't you help me thank Miles for his time here today?
Thank you. Sorry about that. Thank you.
And would you join me in just praying for Miles?
Oh, thank you.
He's got two more of these to do. We're going to Christchurch tomorrow and then Wellington the next day. If you know anyone down there or that you think would benefit from it, send them an email. Let them know. Recommend it to us. And why don't we pray for Miles?
Thank you.
Lord Jesus, I thank you so much for my brother, Mark Miles, and his willingness to come to New Zealand. I pray, Lord, that you bless him during this time, that you give him great wisdom as he leads all the things that he leads in KL. and great patience as well to deal with all the people that he has to deal with as well. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
So thank you so much, guys, for coming along. We've got some of our team here, Nadine and Karina. If you'd like to chat to them about Alpha or anything related to that, they are very happy to chat. Miles will be around for about another 5-7 minutes, and then we'll be taking him somewhere else. Miles is, yes, that's right. But feel free to come and nab him quickly, and then I'll pull him away. And then tonight, we're just having a celebration evening, and inviting the Holy Spirit to come and praying with each other.
Yeah, I was just very aware. I completely overran, and we didn't have a time for ministry, for praying for one another. So tonight's the prayer ministry.
Tonight's the prayer ministry. So 7:30 here again, worship, prayer time, a little bit of talking from Miles, and then more prayer time. Cool? So thank you so much for coming, and thank you so much, Fraser and St. Margaret's, for having us
here. You're welcome.
It's been absolutely brilliant.
What we'd love to do is we're going to just, we've got your email addresses, and we're going to hound you for the rest of your life. But other than that, we're just going to contact you and see whether or not you found this helpful, whether or not something like this would be useful again, and what sort of frequency you might find that helpful. So expect an email in the next sort of 5 to 10 days.
And God, if you didn't give us your email, please give us your email, because otherwise we don't know. We don't get the feedback. And as Miles was talking earlier, that's the information we need to actually either make these things better or make them at a better time for you.
So you can
look, the music has started. Yes. They do that at the Oscars, don't they? Right,
so
I'm off.
Give the information to Jono and his team, and then we'll collate it and contact you.